I'm going to share a little bit from the start of the book, The Heart of Who We Are, Realizing Freedom Together, that Tewari mentioned. So this book came out through Sounds True, and it was an honor to work with them, and it's been rich to be in dialogue with folks about the book since I wrote it. And I didn't get to pick the font size, so I do have some complaints about the fact that I have to use glasses to read my own book. Very small font to me. So it begins with this quote, "Our own self-realization is the greatest service we can render the world." Sri Ramana Maharshi. Our own self-realization is the greatest service we can render the world. By the way, I'll read a little and then we'll take a break, and then Tewari will come back up. We all long to be happy. Not happy as in glee, but deep contentment. We all long to feel at ease, to know that we're okay, that life is okay, to be at peace. And we're deeply habituated to look for this happiness outside us, to grasp and scramble for an experience that, at best, ends up being fleeting, then something we long for again. We forget that this experience we long for is already seated in the heart of who we are, and that it's always here. Have you ever touched this peace, this contentment, this deep knowing of who you truly are, and then struggled because you recognized the degree to which the world around you didn't reflect this experience of our true nature? Our true nature, oneness. Spiritual practice reveals the reality of oneness. Part of me feels called to write about this reality and nothing else, to live quietly, to meditate often, to be still, to perhaps make goat cheese on an island in the Puget Sound with my husband and our dogs. Another part of me can't write or teach about this reality exclusively. I'm propelled by a deep call to address how, in so many spiritual practice settings, this oneness is named and yet is not reflected in our daily lives as practitioners. Not to mention how many report feeling overlooked, excluded, and ignored in prominent spiritual communities, the realities of their lives unseen, even unwelcome. How can I, a former monastic with a lifelong commitment to non-harming, talk about oneness while participating in systems that I recognize as harmful? Systems that I can't be teased apart from. How can I speak about this reality of oneness without addressing the ways we often don't act on behalf of this knowing? How can I recognize the privileges afforded to me based on race and class while also coming to terms with the way in which it's not a, quote, privilege to be part of a system of domination and othering? What do I mean by othering? Actions arising from the perception of separation, behaviors that don't reflect the truth of oneness. This divide speaks to two realities, the reality of interconnection and oneness, the absolute reality, and the reality of isolation and separation, our relative experience, where we enact the shared delusion that we are fundamentally separate from each other on personal and collective levels. There are two truths, the truth of the absolute and the truth of the relative. the relative, the conventional, the material, things as they appear to be, the absolute, the ultimate, things as they truly are, empty. Empty, not as in a grim void or kind of nihilism, not nothingness, but empty of objective experience, empty of language, empty of meaning, empty of separateness. Everything comes from something else. Everything is connected to something else. Nothing, no thing exists in a vacuum. No thing stands on its own. Things simply appear to. Emptiness means empty of limitation. Emptiness means spaciousness. Emptiness means openness. Emptiness, the home of possibility. The great mystery, where nothing is formed and nothing is known. I'm called to speak to both the absolute and relative realities, to reconcile these truths, not to omit any part of reality. How can our personal and collective practices be employed not merely to, quote, transcend the pain of the world, but also to help us accept and be with the pain of the world so we can then transform it, transforming not only individually, but collectively? What are the ways that our spiritual practices have been conditioned to have filters, to be byproducts of the very distortions we aim to see through? How can we not only directly experience oneness, but also apply this experience and understanding to address the impacts of the delusion of separation and pain in the world? But most importantly, not just to address the impacts, but to get to the root issue. I long to live in a world that reflects the reality of oneness rather than the distortion of our shared delusion. I long to live in a world that reflects the deepest truth of our shared being, a term I first heard from the meditation teacher Rupert Spira. I know this world from my meditation cushion in my remote hermitage on the hill. And I know this world from the inside of the walls of public high school classrooms. What's possible reveals itself in countless ways. I don't write about anything that hasn't touched my life directly. Teens who struggle with depression and self-harm, an increasing homeless population in the city I live in, wildfire season, now the norm where so many of us live, loved ones who are affected by racism daily, the recognition that we are all impacted by racism daily, the pain of seeing how I participate in systems that I recognize as harmful, that we all do, this relative plane reality. This reality that so often reflects the pain of living on behalf of the belief that we're separate from each other, the reality where we suffer. How might our direct experience of oneness be brought to bear on this reality? It's been painful, yet also freeing, to wake up to the ways in which I participate in harm. The work of Radical Dharma, based on the book of the same name by Reverend Angel Kyodo Williams, Lama Rod Owens, and Dr. Yasmin Saidullah, has been particularly supportive of my learning, not only around how I participate, but also how I'm affected by these systems, how we all are, how none of us are separate from them. Spiritual practice offers a way to be with this pain, to not run from it, to address it, to transform pain and return to the sanity of the truth of unity. I value being part of collective movements dedicated to the shared journey from the insane to the sane. I know that I'm not alone in longing for this, in being committed to creating this, in valuing this. Throughout my life, I've received tremendous support from others in my practice to expose and end the suffering that happens within. Everyone deserves such support. We all deserve to know our inherent well-being. We deserve to be happy. And at the risk of being overly simplistic, if all had such support, our world would appear differently. I've dedicated my practice to exploring how these supports, the tools, teachings, practices that help us end suffering within, can be applied collectively. Again, I've seen it happen in high school classrooms. I've tasted what's possible. How can these same practices be applied in an even larger world? I believe the only way we'll find out is through experience, by continually exploring how. I'm inspired by the possibility of the awakening of human consciousness at large, the knowing of our oneness at large, and how that knowing collectively might then impact the world. In my recent years as a retreatant and in the public sphere, I've learned much about how the ego, the illusion of a self that is separate from life, operates. The revealing of the ego in action, insights about how it functions, has a particular taste, a particular feel. Freedom has a flavor. I've come to understand how collective systems arising out of the delusion that, quote, we are separate, also have the same resonance as the personal delusion, I am separate, quote. The workings of the ego, which we might think of as operating on a personal level, and the workings of collective conditioning have the same taste. I've had moments of experiencing how and where delusion, personal or collective, manifests and ripples through the mind and the body in the same way, creating the same feel, and seeing through distortion, whether we're seeing through the personal or collective delusion, has its own same feel, the feel of freedom. All that distorts the reality of oneness is, to me, worth seeing, worth naming, worth letting go on any level, in any realm. And freedom is freedom. I'll stop there for now, friends. We will take a break, and then we'll have an opportunity to come back and have some discussion. So, Tiweri, how long is the break usually? Okay, so let's take 5 minutes or so. Come back 5 or 6 after. Thank you.
Okay, so we're back here. I think I can start by asking you a question, and then I took some notes, and I have so many questions I would ask you, so I'm going to settle down and then
ask. We both had a lot of chai together tonight, friends, so...
And then you can ask me some questions or however Great. It unfolds. We're just going to let it happen. We didn't plan it, so this is perfect. I want to start with this one point you made closer to the end. And you said something to the effect that we're called to reconcile, or you were called to reconcile this relative understanding or this relative world we live in and this absolute kind of aspiration that we have as practitioners. And the more I was listening to you and this thought came to me that I really believe that's what the Buddha came to do. He was in this relative world that was so full of dukkha and so full of suffering. And it didn't seem like there was anything going on or any teachings that was helping him get out of that. And yet there was this call to the absolute, to be free of that suffering. And somehow or another, I think his middle path is what he was pointing to as the mechanism or the way to reconcile this relative and absolute. So I'm just wondering if you have similar thoughts. Were you thinking in that way as you're writing this book?
You know, I really appreciate you putting it in that context. And I will say, I actually wasn't thinking very much about the Buddha or the Buddha's life. But as you say it, it resonates as truth. I really was speaking from, I know in my own personal practice, I have to find some kind of reconciliation that I knew giving myself the assignment to write the book would support me in doing. And so, for example, you know, I trained monastically. So yeah. For those that don't know, I trained monastically in the Zen tradition for 8 years. And we never spoke once about systems of systemic oppression in any form. We didn't talk about anything happening in society. There was tremendous benefit, of course, in a very strict focus on my personal practice. But I had no tools in that context for reconciling something beyond what I thought of as my personal practice.
Yeah.
And so there's a way in which the experiences I would have on the cushion, it's like that's what I ended up not knowing how to reconcile with, then coming out in the world and being around teenagers that are cutting themselves or, you know, all the things.
All the stuff.
Yeah. All the things.
That's it. And this is this is the point that I'm pointing to, is that kind of reconciliation you had to do for yourself in order to be in the world and practice at the level of absolute, that's the same reconciliation I think the Buddha had to come to in his own world, trying to understand all the suffering that was happening. And yet there was this liberative possibility. And how can that be true? How can those two things be true? So there's some other things that you touched on that I think really get to the heart of this. So one of the things you touched on was this idea that the oneness that you begin to experience, and yet it wasn't included or named in your ordinary life. Mm-hmm. And this kind of coming out into the ordinary world, how do you say this? It made it necessary. Necessates? Is that something like that? Necessates? Is that?
Necessitates.
I don't know. Necessitates.
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 We are
That's
all
it.
With you.
That's it. Necessitates.
And I know exactly what you're saying, and I cannot call upon the word either.
That's right.
So
That's
we're
okay.
together.
We're
yeah,
good.
It made it. It required me.
That's right.
It required me.
It required
me.
You mm-hmm. to reconcile.
Mm-hmm.
And in some respects, I think this was a moment in the Buddha's life when he was in this kind of relative world and couldn't stay there and reconcile the harshness of that. But when he actually awakened and he was in the absolute world, he couldn't reconcile not going out and teaching yeah. either. So he was torn both in this do I stay in the relative world or do I stay in the absolute world? And somehow over the 45 years of his teaching, he learned to reconcile that this constant reconciliation between the absolute and the relative. Just beautiful, beautiful.
You know, I think it's such an important conversation because there's not true reconciliation until the distortion that they're entirely separate dissolves.
That's your point. That oneness. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what I mm-hmm. was hearing. And it was actually in his coming into his own practice that helped him like mm-hmm. come up with this idea of a middle way mm-hmm. and not two extremes. It's either, you know,
absolute or relative.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. And somehow this practice really touches in that, you mm-hmm. know. This idea, you said that everything comes from something else, beginning to recognize that and see it as part of your practice. And this everything is connected and interconnected mm-hmm. to everything else or something else. And learning to see that as part of your practice is what helps us get to this reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One other point I want to bring up to you. I begin to think of Thich Nhat Hanh mm-hmm. and his, this idea that the next Buddha would be a Sangha.
That's one of the quotes in my book.
I can feel it because mm-hmm. I remember when you were saying that you were inspired by the possibility of the expanded heart at large,
mm-hmm.
like this expanding heart from mm-hmm. all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't come from getting rid of either one of these two truths.
Yeah.
It comes from the reconciliation of them both joined together
mm-hmm.
as being one. So this notion that the delusion or the distraction on our personal level, that you've seen it's the same on the systemic level. Ah, I just thought that was beautiful.
Mm.
I can just keep quoting stuff that you said because I was so taken by it. But I just wonder if this, if you could just explain in the book, how do you approach this subject? So I'm intrigued by the notion of what you're saying, and then how do you approach this in a world that's so divided mm-hmm. and we're so mm-hmm. Conflicted about how to be in the world?
I quite literally take the personal practices and tools that I learned as a monastic and look at how we could apply them collectively. Because again, that was what was left out of my monastic training. So that became sort of the bee in my bonnet of like how, I don't know if that's the right phrase. It wasn't an annoyance. It was a little burning flame of mm-hmm. what might be possible. And I feel in a way that I stumbled upon the question by seeing it happen when I was working, you know, so for those that don't know, I founded a nonprofit called Peace in Schools. Mm-hmm. Don't let me forget to say more about Peace in Schools tonight, because I do. I want to share a little bit about it specifically with Seattle community. But I saw collectives shift. And I knew that was possible from leading retreats for adults, which I also love doing. I love working directly with teens. I love leading retreats for adults. So I knew that was possible in a retreat environment. You and I have countless experiences yep. of feeling an entire retreat start here, and then as a collective, be in a really different place after a week or 10 days or whatever. But to see that happen inside a high school classroom, to see it happen within the context, like I think of it as like the belly of the beast, that began to really inspire me and show me that the next Buddha may be a Sangha.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't about me coming into a high school classroom and having all the answers and disseminating wisdom and, you know, sharing the Dharma. It was about creating the context for shared practice and creating a supportive environment in which a community can become awake to who we truly are together.
Yeah. And I also saw this piece in your Peace in Schools work. This was a class that some students would voluntarily take, but not all the students voluntarily took it. And yet there was this impact on the school itself that had this kind of moving towards a more collective and supportive environment. I don't even want to say awake at this point because it's been so demonized that it isn't some movement towards some woke culture as much as it was a movement towards a shared and collective respect for each other that was on a completely different level, even for people who never took the class, mm-hmm. but yet the schools themselves were beginning to have this kind of respectful shift. And I can't remember all the details now, but I remember, you might remember, somebody had either died or committed suicide, I can't remember, at a school. And the whole school's coming together to support each other around that death was quite touching. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of the schools that we actually visited,
uh-huh.
which was... A way for us to see people talking, teenagers openly talking to each other about mm-hmm. their emotional impact of this and not, not being overly emotional, mm-hmm. Like very reactive and not being sort of this under emotional, like, yeah, it doesn't bother me. It was these conversations that were real.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that came from the work that you guys did with the Peace in Schools,
mm-hmm.
you know, this collective wisdom.
I appreciate that you're bringing in this focus on respect. One of the, and it makes me think too of reverence, like one of the, so we create these environments of care. And now I talk about creating environments of care on my adult retreats as yeah. well. But the care came from the C-A-R-E, came from the first high school class I did, and the teens coming up with what context will allow me to be vulnerable with my fellow classmates and dive into these practices. And so it stands for confidentiality, acceptance, reverence, and empathy. And that's something that I feel that we define reverence as respect tinged with awe.
Yeah.
And I like hear that in what you're saying. It's not just, oh, I respect my fellow human. There's this sense of there's something to be in awe of.
That's right.
Here, just by the fact that we're being together and that we can be honest with each other about our experience of a very intense incident that might have just happened, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
We were doing a research project. There was someone from Johns Hopkins researching our program. And in the day she was visiting my classroom, there was a school shooter on the property. And she ended up focusing some of her research on, you know, I was kind of disappointed from the, once we learned we were all safe, I was kind of disappointed that we weren't doing the lesson that I was hoping she would get to observe. But actually, she ended up writing more about what it was like to watch students practice in real time with what was going on for them, given there was a school shooter on the property.
So the
other point that I want to reflect that you're making is how powerful it is to practice in real time with what is.
Yeah.
So you have to have a container for that, and you have to have a strong community for that. You have to have a community that's got a shared commitment to being awake, or as you said, we don't even have to use that word, to just knowing our own shared humanity and living into that and respecting each other and maybe even finding awe of each other's, for each other's being.
Yeah. And somehow the way you're articulating it and bringing it out, and I'm certain knowing you, weaving it in and out of this book, is that the shared kind of reconciliation that begins to happen doesn't come from knowing the right way or what's the wrong way. It comes from being willing to be with experience, however it is. And however that's showing up, that gradual sense of oneness, that gradual sense of reconciliation, and this interconnectedness just automatically begins to build. I think it just seems like it begins to build a sense of cohesion and collectedness with others in that, I'd say the shared experience that you're having. Yeah, it's just very powerful.
And we're all so hungry for that.
That's right.
You know, because your point is such a good one about it's just such a divided time. And I feel like I've been saying that for years, but it has felt for years like we are living in such divided times, and we're hungry, I think, collectively.
But something else you're pointing to is that just when I think about you and me and what we've seen and what we've gone through in our practice and in our lives, what helped us see the oneness isn't some division. It's really just seeing there's actually no division. It's sort of this learning to see past the superficial level that we're all scared and no one knows what to do and everyone's trying to figure out what's the right way and the wrong way to go through life. And yet, when you go past that, if you're in a community or a collective that has the courage to go past that and begin to reconcile this relative level of where fear lies and this more absolute level where freedom lies, you go past that and then you can actually begin to see that, yeah, we are really all together in this.
You know, you're speaking to one of the reasons I wanted to bring in that approach to meditation this evening, because it's that approach is inviting awareness to be at the forefront of experience.
Yeah.
So rather than I am aware of a thing, but I'm still I'm identifying as a separate witness. So there's still this subtle subject-object relationship being maintained as I sit.
That's right.
What's it like when awareness itself can be the thing that's shining at the forefront of experience? And so what's other than gets to become more transparent or dissolve a little bit?
Yeah.
Because you're speaking to what happens when what's already there gets to come forward. You're not talking about like, oh, we're creating oneness, or we're going out and we're like finding it somewhere because it's often this faraway place and we have to practice for years and years and years to go find.
That's right.
You're talking about what's clouding that experience, getting to dissolve or soften enough so that we can rest and remember what's always there.
That's right. When I think about the Buddha's life itself and just what I've read in his discourses and the way he explained his practice, it unfolded the way you are talking about. It unfolded from him no longer fighting what was arising and actually just using what was arising as the basis of his practice. Mm-hmm. So whatever is agitating him, that was the nature of his practice. Mm-hmm. Whatever was difficult, that was the nature of his practice. And what that would point to in a collective way is that whatever the nature of the times we're in, this is what we're supposed to be practicing with. And that somehow or another, our sense of liberation and peace and the elimination or the ceasing of our fear is not going to come when we get everything fixed and nothing's going wrong anymore. It's going to come when we collectively decide we need to practice with this fear. Mm-hmm. We need to begin to talk to each other about this fear and have more realistic conversations, not the panic reactive conversations, but more like the way the high schoolers were talking to each other about what they were feeling with the person that committed suicide or even with the shooting. It's sort of like they needed to just talk to each other in a more realistic way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's neat that you're saying that, Tuari, because when I first came up with this book proposal, I said to Sounds True, I want to write a book that's only for collectives. Like you have to read it in a collective, practicing with collective to engage with the material. And they were like, yeah, no, you're not. No. Yeah. No. You know, I don't think it's good for book sales to say that you this.
That's right. They weren't in on that.
I think it's very specifically like many people just want to go buy a book and read it. My husband is an introvert. He's not going to go join a collective to go through a collective process around a book. He wants to go get a book and read the book in privacy of his home. And I did end up realizing there's wisdom in writing it in such a way that you could approach the book either way. But to be honest, between you and me, the real light up place for me has been working with folks in community around what the book offers. Because there's as you're pointing to, it's time for these bigger conversations to be able to have a way to be structured. Most people are like, well, that sounds interesting, but I have no idea how to even start that conversation. Yeah. And in a way, I feel like that's all we were doing in the classroom setting, was
that's
saying,
right,
here's some structure so that we can move through practices in a way that's going to really be exploratory and full of inquiry in as safe as possible, as much safety as you can maintain in a collective space.
Yep.
Way.
I remember being struck by the depth of what these high schoolers were talking about. I'm not talking about the depth of their understanding of world politics. I'm talking about the depth of their understanding of their own conditionality, their own habit energy, and being willing to share that with other people in the room. And even share it with visitors in the room that they didn't even know. It was impressive how, having raised two teenagers myself, I know what a teenager conversation is. How you doing? Fine.
Fine.
What you doing? Nothing. Do you need anything? No. I mean, it's like, can we get some more language in there? Couple more words. Okay, I'm doing okay, mama. That's it.
Yeah.
It's like, and yet these teenagers were talking about conditionality, their conditionality, their habit energies to other people. And so I was very impressed. I'm really glad that you've brought all that in. Mm-hmm.